Okay, everyone. I'm showing it at 7:01, so welcome. I don't have any announcements this evening. Are there any quick questions that I can try to answer before we get going? If not, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Don. Are you ready, Don?
No, but I will. I'm never ready. I'm never going to be ready. Let's go ahead and get started. Let's do the prayers first. Can you bring those up, Linda? All right, so we're going to do Taking Refuge, Generating Bodhicitta, Four Measurables, and Mandala Offering. And most people are probably on mute, so you have to, I guess you get to listen to me do it, but that's okay. And then we'll get started. First of all, before we do the point to take refuge, there's before we take refuge, is we always want to remind ourselves of why we're going for refuge. Because remember, we use the term putting a safe and positive direction in our lives. We think of, you know, going to Buddhist refuge, there's actually three motivations we need to remember. The first one is, sounds weird, but it's sometimes it's really called fear, but it's a dread of, like, we all know what a mess, you know, how our mind is sort of wild and out of control, particularly when things don't go our way. It becomes really obvious. And it's pretty painful. So we all understand what it's like to live with a mind that's completely random and out of control. And so, you know, we are caught up in this cycle of samsara, which is uncontrolled causation. Stuff comes up. We react. You know, we have our experience of suffering when we don't get what we want. And even when we get what we want, it didn't last, and then we get frustrated, and we experience a level of suffering, maybe not so obvious, but definitely painful. So anyway, we start out with dread of living the rest of our lives with a mind that is like a magnet for problems and keeps creating more. And we just don't have it together to be able to stay peaceful, even in this life, much less as we approach the time of our death. So, you know, so we have dread. And then we have, the other one is confidence. And that comes with time. That comes, even dread may not be there, or fear of the experience of living life with an uncontrolled mind, but that's pretty easy to see for most of us. But developing confidence in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, confidence in enlightened beings, their teachings, and the spiritual community, confidence, that's really important. So those are the, you know, we take refuge out of dread, and then we take it out of confidence that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can guide us from our current state of confusion and suffering to supreme happiness. And then the third sort of Mahayana motive is compassion, not just for ourselves, but all living beings. You know, is compassion is a motivation for taking refuge, because, you know, when we realize that it's not just us, but it's universal living beings that are suffering, and we want to help, but we don't have it together. But if we follow the guidance of the three jewels, we can develop those qualities within ourselves and be more able to help others stop their suffering. So those are kind of, real briefly again, dread, confidence, and compassion. We always need to reflect on those three things before we do the refuge prayers, just for a moment. So, excuse me. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. The four measurables, remember a measurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness, that's love. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering, compassion. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering, is joy. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends or hatred for enemies. That's equanimity. It's sort of equanimous, even level mind, not clinging, not pushing away, like that. And then the mandala offering is, you know, we see the value of the teachings and we're willing to give up a universe of all this good in order to receive the teachings from the qualified holy gurus. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. Imagine this as a Buddha fill and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radna Mandala Kam Niyata Yami. Okay. So, now. And is that lighting? Is that okay? I think that's kind of how we decided to do it.
Yeah, it looks fine.
Okay. All right. So let's start out with meditation. Geshe Gelug has taught many times. It's called the nine-round breathing. There's some really nice sort of more complicated visualizations to do with it, but we're not going to do that. So we're going to start out by, first of all, you occlude one nostril. So you can take one finger and occlude the right nostril and you breathe in through the left one and then out the right one. And then that'll be one and two, out two and three and out three. And we'll start over again, breathing in on the other side, in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three. And now we breathe in both nostrils and out both nostrils, in one, out one, and two, and out two, three, and out three. And later on we'll do another meditation where we'll visualize the psychic channels that run from the nose and they go back like an umbrella handle and enter the central channel. This has to do with the kundalini energy. It enters the central channel or shushuma, and it goes down, and we can visualize, you know, that that energy going down. And anyway, there's a really nice visualization goes along with it. But we're not going to do that right now. We're just going to do 9-round breathing. We'll do it a couple of times. It's a great practice to help settle your mind anytime, really. When you're agitated, it's really easy to do. And, you know, of course, it looks a little weird putting your fingers over your nose, but it's okay. So everybody do it on their own. And we'll do this for a few minutes, do a couple of rounds. Now, I want you to invite you to take as the object of your meditation your mind, Rina Ravi, guided that whole section on the nature of the mind, how it's clear and knowing, how the mind has this nature of it's unobstructed, it's clear, its clarity. But it also engages with its object, some sort of perception. It could be sensory or mental. So the mind has this nature of clarity and knowing. And I want you to just pay attention to whatever arises in the mind, and particularly pay attention to the impermanent nature of everything that arises. It could be something pleasant. It could be unpleasant. But whatever it is, just notice that it literally comes from the space of emptiness. It arises into our awareness, and then gradually, as we allow it to, it'll just it disappears on its own accord. We don't have to do anything. We just watch the changeable nature of the mind, the impermanent nature of all that arises in this clear and knowing mind. Your mind may be distracted by some sounds, and if your mind is taken away by some sounds, just allow that to become the object of your focus, and notice how they change, the sounds change moment to moment. Everything is in a constant state of flux. It's impermanent. Bodily sensations. Maybe you've been angry or uptight about something, and you can actually viscerally feel something, tightness in your body, and just allow your mind to notice that and notice how it's ephemeral, it's in a constant state of change and flux. And then see if you can actually let it go. And ask yourself, is living my life with a mind that is constantly, and a body, mind and a body, that's in constant state of change and flux? How satisfying is that? Is it really satisfying? When we're constantly clinging to pleasure and clinging to concepts of trying to avoid the opposite of pleasure, say, for example, pain. So we're always, as this great Buddhist saint Ajahn Buddhadasa in Thailand said, we're addicted to deliciousness, but it always changes. That ice cream, if you keep eating it, it'll make you sick. Everything is in a state of change. Could never bring us lasting satisfaction. As long as we cling. And then where's the self in this? You know, we think there's a self that's experiencing pain or anger or stress. You know, as we watch our mind in this uninterrupted state of flux, our body and mind, this is really changing literally billions of times every microsecond. Constantly changing, changing, changing. Where is the self in that? We say, my anger, my pain, my happiness, my pleasure. Where is that self? The owner of those experiences. And we realize we can't find it. It's just this uninterrupted process of change. And if we go, oh, there's the self, well, it's already changed. We're already into the next moment of experience. So the concept of self is just that. It's something that we add to experiences, labeling them mine or I, when in fact it's just an uninterrupted flow of impermanent processes of body and mind. Of course, we do exist, and we do have things, but that's on that's not on an ultimate level. That's on a relative level. So, again, relax your concentration. I don't know if anybody can hear the racket outside my door, but can you hear it, Linda?
Annabelle? Just a little bit. It's not bad.
Yeah, I might have to go and get that girl.
It's not loud. We're all home. Who knows what's happening in the background? I have a puppy asleep on the floor.
Yeah.
And she's liable to wake up.
Yeah, that's okay. So anybody last week do their, let's see how many hands go up. And the reaction room, is that where you... Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, if you meditated this past week, and I requested 5 days, but let's just say if you meditated, if you had at least three sessions of what I'd call formal, you know, time that you set aside for practice, please... Put your thumb up. Oh, wait a minute. Raise your hand. Raise your hand. Yeah. There you go. Let's see. Thumbs up, raised hand. Yeah. Good. So it's always good, you know, you want to get the most out of these classes. Obviously, it's really important to do the practices as much as you can during the week. Otherwise, you know, it's nice to hear the Dharma. I love to hear the teachings, but that's not the point. The point is to put them into practice. And the point really, at some level, I mean, to really have any motivation to practice, you got to have a clear intention. You got to have something going on that, like, okay, why do I need this? You know, you got to get deeper than, oh, I just want to be happy. You know, that's good. I mean, that's not bad. That's fine. That's a good reason. But you know, as Mahayana Buddhist, at least trying to practice Mahayana Buddhism, we call it effortful bodhicitta. And it's just something I'm inviting you, everyone, including myself, every day. You know, it's good to wake up in the morning. Lama Zopa has this little prayer that maybe some of you memorized. Goes along, something along the lines of, by the grace of the three jewels, I didn't die last night. I'm so fortunate to be a human being again today. May I be able to benefit all sentient beings with compassion and love, like that. So you start out your day. Actually, Lama Zopa also says, and we'll do a death meditation tonight, by the way. Something people, I don't know, if you want to cut out for that when you can, but I invite you to do it because I think it's a very powerful practice. But Lama Zopa, he suggests that first thing you think of in the morning is, I'm going to die today. This is it. This is my last crack at the game of life. Okay? And don't know what's going to happen in the next life. Hope there's a next life. And I hope I've got good karma to get there and to have a good next life. We don't know that for sure, but the Buddhist teachings say that that's the case. So we try to, those of you who are trying to, I suggest the way I describe it is creatively align with the teachings. That, for example, a lot of these things we don't have proof of some of these things now, but our teachers say that eventually we will be able to see the workings of karma directly. But now we cannot. You know, we're taught, well, if you kill, you'll be killed. If you steal, you'll get ripped off. If you, commit adultery, you'll have lousy relationships. And so on. We can see at some level that makes it's logical, but maybe not, we can't prove it 100%. But the teachings say that it's very important to have a little bit of faith in the Buddha, in Buddhism and the basic teachings of Buddhism, to make any serious progress along this path. Anyway, so so any questions, comments?
There is one on the YouTube stream. Julie says, the best kind of finding is not finding. How does that refer to someone who has chronic pain? I know that there is not a real me, but what about pain that seems real?
Well, so I don't know if you've ever had the experience of, I mean, I have, of sitting in meditation and where I would be sitting for like a long period of time, maybe, I remember there was one time I was in Japan and I was doing a sesshin. That's like a meditation retreat, lasts a week long. And we'd sit for 50 minutes, walk for 10 minutes. You talk about suffering. I mean, that was brutal. Sit for 50, walk for 10, sit for 50. And the idea was you'd have to sit there like a stone Buddha and not move, not even move for 50 minutes. When my knees were screaming at me, you know, this happened session after session after session, day after day. But in every session, when I would pay attention to the sensation that I was labeling pain, right, it would change. And sometimes it would completely disappear. And actually sometimes it would change into a pleasurable sensation. And then the pain would come back. Or the sensation that I was labeling pain. Again, pain, there's no inherently existent pain that exists independent of my mind labeling it. So it's a series of sensory data that our mind, that's unpleasant, definitely unpleasant. I'm not saying that it's pleasant, but we label it pain. But we can't find pain. We cannot find any pain that exists, like, for example, in that knee that exists independent of my mind labeling it. So you can't find it. So the non-finding of pain is the best finding. To see that it's empty. The pain is empty. It doesn't exist in and of itself. It exists in dependence upon causes and conditions. Independence upon moments of mind, which we can call parts. And independence upon a consciousness that labels it pain. There's no pain that exists other than that. There's no real pain that exists other than, you know, these things that I just described. Is, and we cannot find it. We can't find any inherently existent pain. No, in the same way we can't find the inherently existent self. You know, we exist in dependence upon causes and conditions. Of course, we parts, you know, a head, fingers, atoms, whatever you want to say, lots and lots of parts. And we exist in dependence upon a mind that labels me as Don, for example, as I. And that's how I exist. We call it's called this, the king of reasoning in Buddhism. It's called dependent arising. Everything arises or comes into existence in dependence upon causes and conditions, parts, and a mind that labels it. And you go, well, that's not such a big deal. You know, why is it, you know, what's so profound about that? What's profound about it is that the way we think things exist is exactly the opposite of that. We think that things do exist inherently in and of themselves, independent of causes and conditions and parts and the consciousness that labels it. It exists out there and it's real. When in fact, what, for example, usually when you meditate on emptiness, you usually start with yourself. And what you do is you start looking for the I, you know, and you look for the I in the body, can't find it. You look for the I in the moments of mental consciousness, you can't find it. It's just a flux of bodily sensations and mind moments. And know, we look for those things and we can't find it. But we feel so strongly that there is a real I. We can really see that I when we get angry or we have some strong emotion, be it lust or fear or anger or whatever it is, some strong emotion. Whenever we experience that, there's an irrefutable sense of a hardwired sense of I. Or when somebody embarrasses you and you go, or says something mean, you go, how dare you say that to me, right? We say that. Or, I can't stand it anymore. I can't take this anymore. I. The emphasis is on I. But that's the I that in Buddhism we call the object of refutation. That's the I that we believe in, that ignorance projects, and we believe in our heart of hearts it truly exists, and we cling to it, and we make all of our decisions based on how it gets treated or mistreated, when in fact, it doesn't exist at all. It's a mere, the I that exists is a merely labeled I. That's it. It's just a merely labeled I. But that's not how we feel. We feel I do exist and I am real. And gets us into all kinds of problems because somebody insults you or calls you names, you get mean, you get angry. Or somebody does something to a friend of yours or something you don't like, you know, we react. Or we see something that is delicious. Or some could be a person, it could be food, it could be some drug that we're addicted to. And whatever it is, you know, we see it as inherently delicious, wonderful. We have to possess it. I want that. So that's a long-winded answer, but I think this is an important reason I'm kind of going a little bit longer, talking about emptiness and this selflessness. Is that the Dalai Lama says that, for example, he says there are a lot of concepts in Buddhism that we cannot easily prove, you know, for example, karma, cannot easily prove that, future lifetimes, our own potential to become enlightened or to achieve nirvana, you know, things like that. We have to take those things on faith. To some degree, we have to take them on faith. And so His Holiness says that that's a big step, particularly for Westerners. He said, but the teachings on emptiness, you don't need to have any faith at all. All you need to do is look and see. It's so clear when we do the analysis that there is no I that exists that way. When we start to look for that inherently existent hardwired I that we feel so strongly exists, we can never find it. It's a non-finding of that projected I that is emptiness. We are empty of or void of that mistaken perception of I, that inherently existent hardwired I, the object of refutation, what they call the object of refutation, is this belief in a real I that's projected by ignorance, okay? It's projected by ignorance. We project a false sense of I, and we believe in it. We cling to it with all of our heart and mind. That's true. And the Buddha is saying, no, it's not true. When we look for it, we cannot find it. We're empty of that self. What we can find is a self that exists in dependence upon causes and conditions, parts, and a consciousness that labels it. Okay? The merely label I. That does exist. But that other one doesn't exist. So this, the king of reasoning, these dependent arising, proves that things are empty. It proves that they're empty. So it's really helpful to, you know, and I don't know if Robbie went into that in any detail, but there's a whole class on emptiness, which is very important that you, it is the, and understanding this is like, remember the Four Noble Truths we talked about last week? The way I teach, I try to teach this to my kids, but I'm sorry, they don't care that much. Anything I try to teach them, they immediately like negate. But you know, I say, look, the Four Noble Truths, is, the easy way to think about it is we're, you know, because I'm a doctor, right? That's my job. We're sick. We're all sick. And then I say there's a cause for the illness. And it can be cured. And here's the medicine, right? So the first noble truth is dukkha, the truth of unsatisfactoriness, you know, pain and suffering. And you know, we talked about this, the suffering of the pain, the suffering of pain, the suffering of change, the pervasive suffering, and birth, sickness, and old age, and death, all the obvious things. That's that we're sick. And that there's a cause for it, which is karma and delusions. All the delusions, anger, fear, hatred, pride, jealousy, all of those delusions plant seeds in our mental continuum that will ripen into the first noble truth, suffering. So karma and delusions, that's the cause of the illness. And then great news, we can be cured. This again, can't prove it. Got to creatively align. But the Buddha says, not only are we sick and there's a cause for it, but it can be cured. And this, the cure is called nirvana. It's complete freedom from suffering. And the only way to get that is to cut the tap root. And the tap root is wisdom, the wisdom of emptiness. So important. Because when we eliminate the self-cherishing I, all of a sudden, anger and fear, jealousy and pride don't have any basis. And love and compassion and spaciousness and generosity and kindness, all the positive states of mind just spontaneously can arise when they're not sort of smothered by our selfishness. Okay, so then third noble truth, we can be cured. Fourth noble truth, here's the medicine. Here's the medicine. The Lam Rim, you know, renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, generation and completion stage of tantra, and so on. This, so there's like, yeah, we're sick. There's a cause for the sickness. It can be cured. And here's the medicine. That's the four noble truths that the Buddha taught. It's real, important to know those teachings. Anybody who wants to be, who wants to practice Buddhism, and that's through all the traditions of Buddhism, always, teach those. I mean, everybody agrees that that's the basic teachings of all of Buddhism.
And Don, to add to what you're saying, that the next module 3, is presenting the path.
Okay.
And then emptiness isn't until like module 12, so that comes up much later.
Well, it actually comes up all the time, because if you present the path, the third note, if you're presenting the three principles of the path, the third principle of the path is emptiness, but the module on emptiness goes into more depth. Yeah,
emptiness is touched on, I think, in most modules. And then Meredith wants to know, is dependent arising the same thing as emptiness?
No, it's the proof of emptiness. Because things arise or come into existence when causes and conditions, they're empty of existing independent of causes and conditions, right? Because things arise or come into existence in dependence upon parts, they're empty of being solid, you know, hardwired, like they appear to be. Because things arise and come into existence in dependence upon a consciousness that labels it, it proves that things don't exist out there independent of my mind labeling it. In our reality, we think everything out there is just as, when we look at like this rosary, when you look at this, you go, oh, everybody's seeing the same rosary. No, everybody's having a different, seeing a different rosary. But our mind thinks everybody's seeing the same thing, but it's not. Each of us have our own interpretation and our own projection of everything. And yet it seems to have existence in and of itself out there, independent of our mind. You get that? If we really think about it, when we look out there, we don't think that we are projecting our reality. We think it exists out there, and I'm just observing it. And everybody else is seeing the same thing I am. But clearly, you know, it's not the case. It's not the case. We all are having our own unique karmic projections. This is the good stuff. And I'm where, you know, when we label something, where's it coming from? You know, for example, you couldn't label this a cell phone unless you'd what? Seen a cell phone before. Then you could say, oh yeah, that's a cell phone. But based on something that you experienced that you had in the past. It's the same way. Right now, the Buddhists would say our karma, like, and remember what you said, in the finger snap, there's 60 mind moments, but it's literally billions of karmic seeds ripening continuously to force us to see the world a certain way. And it's, where are these seeds coming from? They're coming from our former actions. Virtuous actions are forcing us to see ourselves as happy. Non-virtuous actions plant karmic seeds that literally ripen, and those flowers, they're not flowers at all, they're weeds. They're forcing us to see ourselves as suffering. So karma continuously ripening is the source of the labeling. You know, everything exists and depends upon a mind that labels. Well, guess what? Those are billions of karmic seeds ripening, and they're the fruit of past actions. Our actions are body, speech, and mind. That's why 2/3 of the Buddhist teachings have to do with ethics, living ethically, because our whole life is created by our actions of body, speech, and mind. If we're constantly creating negative karma, we're creating the causes to project a hellish existence in this and future lifetimes. If we're living a mind of compassion and kindness and respect and, you know, and virtuous actions, we'll be forced to see ourselves literally in paradise. You know, our karma will ripen, and we'll have, you know, a happy life. And we all want a happy life. So we always talk about, at least I do, I try to remember at the beginning of these modules to say, look, at least during the course of the next 5 weeks, you know, try to live by as many of the lay precepts as possible. The lay precepts, in Buddhist countries, there are 5 of them. One of them is avoid intoxicants. That one's hard to do for a lot of us because, you know, some people like wine or beer or whatever, you know, but getting, or whatever your drug of choice is, but, you know, getting, you know, becoming literally distracted or unconscious is really the point of avoiding. It's not that there's anything wrong with, intoxicants or anything like that, but when we're intoxicated, then we'll do the other 4 things without thinking about it. Adultery, stealing, lying. Lying, stealing, killing, and sexual misconduct. And then intoxicants. Those are the 5 lay precepts. So you can see, if you get loaded, you can do the other four right quite easily without thinking, because you're not paying attention. So it's really important to be mindful of, and this is like the beginning of mindfulness practice. You set limits on your behavior, on your actions, and then when you stray, when your mind goes off in the direction of something that's non-virtuous, you catch yourself and you bring your mind back. And that's the practice of mindfulness. That's why ethics are so important in Buddha Dharma for all the reasons I said and more. Any thoughts about what I just said?
We had some other comments earlier, Don. Do you want me to read those out to you now?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Randy was sharing that that chronic pain is sometimes too much, and he has just a simple question. How can I tell my neck to stop hurting when it's there 24 hours a day?
Mm.
And then also right along those same lines, Jeff shared that they have chronic pain. One thing that helps is to change posture. Sometimes we meditate standing, sometimes walking, sometimes sitting, sometimes laying down. Sometimes the pain dictates the best method.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've got my own chronic pains. We all have, if you live long enough, you're going to have it. And so I think one of the ways to talk about it is, tell you what, I want to go get some water. And I know that if I just keep going on and on and on, people are going to, their minds are going to go blank. So let's take about a 3 to 5 minute break and, stand up and stretch. I'm going to go get a glass of water, and when we come back, we'll talk about pain, physical and mental pain, actually.
Sorry, Don, I had muted you, so if you can unmute. Try one more time, sorry.
There you go.
There you go.
This was in Whole Foods the other day, and I just thought that was, you know, everybody's talking about mindfulness. I like the word kindfulness.
I saw that, Don. Is it worth picking up? I didn't get it.
Very cool. It's got a lot of, I just skimmed it and read a few of the meditations in there. It's very nice. But the whole idea of kindness and bringing that kind of mind to our experiences is really, really cool and very helpful.
If you want to weave this in, I know you're going to talk about pain. But someone had mentioned that about killing, that killing includes killing bugs and trees because all our life being virus and bacteria too. So what to do?
You know, I always love these questions. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to make a mental note about those questions, and we'll come back, you know, if we have time, at the end of this course, we'll touch back on some of these things. And these questions come up in every class. So if you don't get an answer this time, you can ask if you're in the next module. But, there's things do get killed. And the point is to try to respect life, really see the sacredness of life. That's the real point of it, of the teachings on avoiding killing. Sometimes you can't avoid it. But, what was the other question again?
So the other was about the pain and what to do with chronic pain, like that's 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And then one more piece was on YouTube, Julie's asking in regards to, I believe this is correct, in regards to when you are meditating on the I, and, you know, the me and the self, she's asking, is it normal to feel dizzy or you can't find yourself or maybe scared?
Actually, that's the teachers say that when you go looking for the I, and when you, if you get a little scared, that's actually a good thing. Because you realize that something that you held as sacred and true doesn't exist at all. And so for meditators who are really good at it, meditating on emptiness, there's a fear factor there when they realize that they cannot find the I that they really believed in, the object of reputation. Fantasized way as Alice Berzin and Tibson Children loves it. You know, they're good buddies. So Alex calls, you know, he says fantasized ways of existing, talking about inherent existence, but that false sense of I, when you start looking for it, you can't find it. Yeah. You get a little bit scared. And if it's too much, you can pull back. You don't want to go too far. And it might not be, you might not be ready to go any further into it. I mean, some people, the teachings on emptiness, they're not ready to hear, you know, they're not ready to do the real serious practices yet. They need to do more of the preliminary practices to prepare their mind to get the result that they're looking for in the meditations on emptiness. That makes sense? So that was a good question. Let's talk about pain, because, you know, I'm certainly not saying that pain, 24/7 pain is not pain. It is pain. Okay. And I'm going to use the example. It's not going to answer your question directly, but it's going to give you sort of a sense of it. There's a teaching called the eight worldly concerns, or the eight worldly truths, or the eight worldly dharmas, or let's see, Chogyam has an, she calls them eight worldly concerns too. Lamazopa calls them eight worldly dharmas. But they're basically, it's the mind clings. And I've mentioned this before. I mentioned Ajahn Buddhadasa saying, we're addicted to deliciousness. What I'm saying is that the mind clings to everything that's pleasant. And the four things that you know, and the eight worldly concerns that are considered to be just general categories, one of them is pleasure. Okay? We cling to pleasure. We want pleasure. And the more we're addicted to pleasure, the more what happens when we don't have it. The more we suffer when we don't have it. And when we get pain, we really suffer when our mind is obsessing about pleasure. Or when we hate, when we are attached to not having pain, it just makes it worse. Pushing it away just makes it worse. So we're addicted to deliciousness. So pleasure, gain, material gain, relationships, money, you name it. Great jobs, all those things, all the stuff that we want, nice car, nice house, nice wife, nice kids, nice this, nice that, we, you know, nice, you know, great sex life. We all want all of those things, all those pleasurable experiences. We all want them. There's nothing wrong with wanting these things. It's the craving, the addiction to deliciousness that creates the problems. And when we want, so the first one was pleasure. The second one is we want gain. Okay, so gain's usually stuff, right? So if I'm addicted to my, if I'm like really attached to my new car, and then somebody comes along the side of the car and keys the car, it's like, oh my God, it feels like they're keying me. Like they just hurt me because I'm so attached to the car. And so, or when somebody steals my car, like I really suffer because I'm attached to my car. So, and if I want a car, but I don't have a car, I'm not happy. If I'm attached to the car when I get it, I can't really take single-minded enjoyment in it because I'm so afraid somebody's going to put a mark on it, or when it gets dirty, I got to go take it and get it cleaned. And you know, if anything bad happens to it, I take it personally. And then if I lose it, it's like the worst thing ever. Okay, so again, this clinging addiction to deliciousness creates a lot of the problems because we can't get away from pain. We can't get away from loss. The other two are like, pleasure, gain, praise, like having nice things said about us, you know, and disapproval. Man, we crave approval. Like you cannot believe it. I want people to like me so much. And when they tell me they don't like me or they tell me they hate me, boy, that's really painful because we cling. We want the delicious stuff. And then they say the hardest one is a good reputation. That's what we want more than anything is a good reputation. And so getting a bad reputation, having people bad mouth us, that goes right to the heart. We crave deliciousness. We crave, you know, pleasure, gain, praise, and good reputation. And we crave to not experience their opposites, which are pain and loss and disgrace and blame. And the more I crave not to experience pain, guess what? It only makes it worse. and it makes it hang around. Because we're clinging to it. We're clinging to the thought, I can't stand pain. You know, whereas if we can let go and see the impermanence of it and allow it to be, maybe we won't suffer so much. I mean, there are people that have different pain thresholds, you know. For example, the Eskimos, you know, I can remember being in Bengal, India one time, and there were like 100,000 Tibetans that had come to hear the Dalai Lama teach the Kala Chakra. This was back in the mid-80s. And I was working in a health clinic, and there was one Tibetan guy. He came in, and he had, I mean, they still wore the clothes that they wore at 18,000 feet above sea level, but it was 100 degrees in Bodh Gaya, so they were sweating, and they had all kinds of skin infections. And this guy had this giant abscess, and I said, you know, I was talking to the translator. I said, do you mind telling him I'm going to numb it up, and then I'm going to lance it? And she told him that. He said, no, don't numb it up, just lance it. So I took a scalpel blade and I just cut it, and he didn't move. He had this incredible, I mean, it didn't, he didn't like this, he didn't recoil at all. He just sat there and let me drain this abscess. Anybody else would have freaked out. At least I would have. So you get a little taste of how our attachment to pleasure creates an aversion to pain. And so when we experience pain, it only makes it worse. If we can see that that's just part of life. Pleasure's part of life. Pain's part of life. Gain's part of life. Loss is part of life. Praise is part of life. Being disgraced is part of life. Good reputation sometimes, bad reputation other times. That's called samsara. This is the world we live in, uncontrolled, out of control. And if we're clinging all the time, our mind is on a roller coaster. But when we can let go and just be in the present and not cling, it's very simple, very easy. One thing Ajahn Buddhadasa said, he was talking about this addiction. Well, he was just talking about practicing Dharma in general. He said, you know, when we're doing our meditation practice, for example, and we notice that we're angry, or that we're, maybe we have a, you know, let's say we're angry about something that somebody did, and the anger arises in our mind, and then we are mindful of the anger. So that's really cool. Now, instead of being swept away by the anger, we're mindful of the anger. We go, oh, I'm angry. We note that we're angry. And then we reach into our Dharma medicine cabinet and we bring the medicine of impermanence to that experience. That's the wisdom of impermanence. And we notice, we sit with that anger, watching it change. Anger. You can even label it softly. Anger. And at some point, it disappears. And then he said, you really feel clever. And because you've used the Dharma wisdom. He said, that's when you're practicing Dharma. Up until then, you know, you've been listening to all these words, and that's not practicing Dharma. But it's when you're in the, when you have a problem and you can bring Dharma wisdom to solve your problem, that's the practice of Dharma that's important for all of us to learn. So that's kind of gives you some things to think about pain, physical pain in particular, but mental pain as well. Depression is the same way. We all want to be happy all the time. And when we're stressed or depressed, we hate it. And the more we hate it, the more it sticks around until we can open to the experience and see it as impermanent and let it pass through us. That's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but that's the Buddhist, that's the part, one of the Dharma medicines to help treat depression. Another one is to see the preciousness of this life, that this life is precious. It is so transient. It is so short. It is so, you know, I don't care if you're 20 years old or 15 or you're 85. It doesn't matter because, you know, nobody knows when they're going to die. Could be any moment. It is so precious. Why is the life precious? Now, I can tell you, I've got one of my children, well, actually all of them probably the same. They don't get it. They don't see that life is meaningful. And from a Buddhist perspective, life is meaningful because we can use this precious human life to solve all of our problems, to achieve supreme happiness, nirvana, and actually even enlightenment. So it's a precious life. It's not precious because of how many parties we can go to or how much money we can put in our 401k or how much, you know, you name it. You fill in the blank. It's not precious. Those are nothing wrong with those things. But the Buddhist perspective is this life is precious because we can find what we want in our heart of hearts, which is true, lasting peace, joy, and happiness. That's what we really want. And everything else is a ruse. It's a smokescreen. I could go on and on, but I did want to do the death meditation. So I've kind of touched on it already. So let's everybody just kind of settle into a meditation posture, take maybe three deep cleansing breaths. And as I said earlier, if you don't want to do this meditation, if you kind of don't want to confront this particular reality, then that's fine. You can mute me. I won't take it personally. But you know, in Buddhism, it's really important to be aware of not only what we've been talking about tonight about subtle impermanence, you know, how the mind and body are in a constant state of flux and change and impermanence, but also gross impermanence, particularly the fact that we're going to die. And the reason that's so important is if when we have a constant awareness of, like Lama Zopa said, when you get up tomorrow morning, think, I'm going to die today. I promise you, you'll approach the day differently than if you think when you wake up tomorrow morning, I got forever. You know, I'm not going to die today. I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do my Dharma practice some other time. I got a lot of time. No problem there. So this is a crucial, really important meditation for us to bring with the awareness that this is a precious life. So the first thing we want to remember is that death is definite. Death is definite. That, and these things really seem pretty obvious, right? I mean, we're not talking about anything that's, this is real. There's nobody that we know. I mean, look at all the people, the famous people, You know, where's Abraham Lincoln? Where's George Washington? Where's Jesus Christ? Where are all the famous people in history now? They're dead. You know, everybody dies. There's really no debate about it. But I can promise you, in your heart of hearts, you don't think you're going to die. You think there's something in within each of us to think that we're going to be the one that beats death, the deathless state. We can beat it. That's the ego, by the way, that feels like it's permanent. But in fact, it's impermanent. It's in a state of flux. But no, we have a sense of this permanent, hardwired sense of self that will endure forever. And it's not true. We will all die. Everybody dies. And nothing can prevent us from eventually dying. Our lifespan cannot be extended like with each passing moment. Like the tick of the clock, each passing moment. Now we breathe in, but we breathe out. But you know, you can't get that moment back. It's gone. That time is gone. And each passing moment is bringing us closer to the time when somebody will look at our body and say, she or he is dead. That's going to happen to you. It's going to happen to me. It's going to happen to everybody. So death is definite. We got to get that in our bones. And when the conclusion that we draw from that meditation on the fact that death is definite and everybody dies and this life is so precious is that we must practice the Dharma. We cannot waste our life, you know, chasing rainbows or trying, you know, one more time to, you know, to get pleasure out of something that is never going to bring us pleasure, never going to bring us happiness, true lasting happiness and joy. We've been, you know, we're like a rat going down the same tube looking for the cheese. There's no cheese down that tube, but we don't get it. So be aware that death is definite and we must practice the Dharma. We must practice the essence of the Buddha's teachings, which is basically realizing the nature of our own mind, purifying it, and experiencing the joy of nirvana. We can do that. So death is definite, and the time of death is to be any moment. There are people that woke up this morning and they're dead now, and they didn't think they were going to die. It doesn't take much. I mean, we all know these little viruses that are floating around. You know, there's a lot of them. I mean, the COVID-19 is nothing compared to some of the other ones, you know, that are really evil and lethal. COVID-19 is 5 times more lethal than the flu, but there are other infections and bugs that will kill you a lot quicker than that will. Blood clots, little tiny, tiny little blood clots. Our life is over just in 1 second. Heart attack and die, stroke and die. Or one cell goes berserk. One little cell in one organ goes berserk, mutates, forms a cancer. Boom. You know, within some period of time, we're dead. We don't know when. So the time of death is completely random. We think we have forever. But time of death is uncertain. So many things that can bring about our death. I mean, could be a virus, could be a blood clot, could be a cancer, could be our car. A lot of the things that we count on to make our lives easier, like our cars, can be the source of our death. Or our vacations. We want to go on vacation with our family, so we go to a beautiful beach and somebody drowns. Or while we're there, the plane crashes and everybody dies. You know, so many of the things that we count on to bring us happiness and pleasure can be the source of our demise. It could be any minute. It could be any moment. So the first contemplation is that death is definite. And the conclusion is, I must practice the Dharma. Because I'm going to die. I must practice the Dharma and plant those positive seeds on my mind stream that will ripen into happiness. And the time of death can be any moment. Wake up tomorrow morning and think, I'm going to die today. And see how that changes your attitude about your Dharma practice. Because the conclusion to that meditation of that the time of death is random. It could be any moment. Is that I must practice the Dharma and I must do it now. I must not procrastinate. And then the third point is that we try to look. It's like the only thing that's of any help at the time of death is our Dharma practice. Are the imprints that we place on our mind through the spiritual practice. Okay? So our 401k, no help. Our bank account, no help. Our family and the people that we love and adore us and are standing by our bed weeping and wailing and telling us to stay and please don't die and, you know, no help. And our friends, no help. And our job, no help. And all the negative karma that we created in our lives just to take care of this body and mind and give it pleasurable experiences, all that negative karma, we have to face it in our future lifetimes. No help at the time of death. And even this, we think, well, you know, this thing that we hold so precious, our body, we take such good care of it. We try to find nice places to take it and nice sensual experiences to give it. And, you know, but eventually it's actually our body that's abandoning us. This is the end of this one. Even our body can't save us at the time of death. It's actually what's dying. Is our body, the physical body. It's coming to an end. So the conclusion is that I must practice the Dharma now, and I must practice it purely. Okay, this third point of the only thing that is any benefit at the time of death is our Dharma practice. Yeah, that's true. And we must practice the Dharma now, and we must practice it purely. We must practice the pure Dharma. That means we must understand the teachings, you know, from a valid source, and we must make effort to internalize the meaning of the teachings through our meditations and through our study and through, you know, listening, contemplating, and meditating on the various aspects of the Dharma so that when our time of death does come, we can face it fearlessly. We can face death with joy and completely fearlessly, with no regrets. Like, I lived my life to the best of my ability. I did the best I can. You know, I made a difference. I made a difference in my life. I didn't hurt people. I tried to help them, and so on. You know, so we try to practice the pure Dharma, because that's really the only thing that's going to help us at the time of our death. If at the time of your death, you can remember Tonglin, like you can think as you're lying on your deathbed and, you're kind of working to breathe and the doctors have said, he's a goner. But you're working to breathe and you're thinking of all the people in the world that are suffering right now from the fear of death and dying. And you imagine that you take all of their fear into your heart, which destroys your self-cherishing, and you breathe out joy and fearlessness and happiness and enlightenment and nirvana. You breathe out this to universal living beings. And then you breathe in other suffering, which is compassion, right? And you breathe out the light of loving kindness. And so as you're dying, just like Christ on the cross, I'm taking on the suffering of the world and giving back everlasting life. Compassion and love, right? So if we can die with that kind of mind rather than freaking out, and we know, most of us know, I mean, if you've ever seen somebody die, if you've seen people in accidents or things like that, or worked in emergency rooms or places where, most of us have seen people die or been around that. But most people are not totally at peace with it at all. Some people are, and it's amazing to see that. That's how we want to be. So our death is definite. I must practice the Dharma. The time of death is indefinite. I must practice it now. The only thing of benefit at the time of my death is the only currency I can spend at my death time is spiritual currency, imprints placed on my mind stream through Dharma practice. So I must practice the pure Dharma now. But that's the conclusion. Okay, let's do our dedication prayers and we'll wrap it up.
Okay, give me 1 second.
Okay.
There we go.
All right. I got another version right here that I can actually read on the computer screen. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid of a little with a mind weighed down by depression. May the deaf hear sound and those bodies whose worn his body, those whose bodies are worn with, hang on a minute. I'm trying to find it. Okay. I'll have to read it from here. All right. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth and those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and may those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Amen. All right. Well, thank you.
Is there certain meditations you want us to focus on for homework this week?
No, there is. Let me pull them right up here. So I want to do, I don't think the 9-point, 8 worldly concerns, was that part of last week?
Do you have the number in front of you? What was that one?
I think it was,
we did B6, B7, C4, and D1 last week.
Okay, D1. D1 was a 9-point death meditation, and C4 was 8 worldly concerns. All right, so I'd like to do D3, D4, D5, 6, 7, and 8. It's just 6 meditations.
Okay.
No, it's just 5, actually.
That's 6.
6, okay.
You good with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week.
Next week. Bye. Thank you, Linda.
Bye. Thanks, Don.
Thank you, Linda. Appreciate it.